Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. It's another Writer's Routine. Today, our guest is a farmer by day and a storyteller by night. His name is James Oswald. He runs a 350-acre livestock farm up in Scotland in Fife. And during the day, he herds his ewes, he ploughs the land, and then during the night, he has written a whole range of crime and fantasy stories. He's found great success with his Inspector Tony McLean books, and after 8 of those, he's back with a brand new series. It's all about Constance Fairchild. It's called No Time to Cry, and it starts with a brutal murder in an office. Now, we'll talk about the writing room that he built to spec above his garage. There's also some chatter about the classic car that he's trying to fix just below him in the actual thing. You can find out why he writes 7 days a week as well, and why, for him, research isn't all it's cracked up to be.
I'm one of these truly lazy people who put a lot of effort into being lazy. I'm also a little bit shy about and nervous about going to the police and asking them questions. I don't want to waste their time. So I've kind of developed a strategy of working around it. And you'll find in that book, she's a police officer. She's working in a small team undercover. We don't even name what department that's in.
So stay there. It's all on the way in this week's Writer's Routine. Hello, yes, this is Writer's Routine, the show where we take a look inside the daily diary of someone creative. Before we get into it, let me very quickly remind you of the single greatest way that you can help out this show if you're enjoying what we're doing. And that's if you're listening to us on iTunes, head to their podcast store and leave us a review. Find Writer's Routine, write something nice about us if you've got the time. Drop us 5 stars, please, because it helps with their strange, unknowing, pesky iTunes chart. And it lets other people who could use the help of our authors find the help of our authors. It'll become more available to them. It's honestly the best way that you can help us out. Just head over to the iTunes podcast store and leave Writer's Routine a review. So let's get into this week's episode then, taking a peek inside the working day of James Oswald. James is a cattle and a sheep farmer up in Scotland during the day. Then at night, he locks himself away in a purpose-built writing room, if we all had the luxury, which is just above his garage. And he writes stories, mainly crime stories now. He's published 8 books in the Inspector Tony McLean series, 4 in another fantasy saga, The Ballad of Sir Tony Benfro, and his new book, it tells the tale of Constance Fairchild. It's called No Time to Cry. It's a crime book about police procedural matters, although, as we've already heard earlier on, he doesn't really do that much research into any of the procedures, just kind of watches the bill, I think. You can find out more about that in just a sec. Also, how he manages his day when he's got 50 sheep to tend to, and also how he finds the time to write when he's been up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get to work on the farm. There's a lot of talk as well about the names of characters in this show, because James pretty much made up his whole story when he simply thought of the name Constance of his lead character. So if you're one of those that's nerdy for names, I promise you'll love this. Also, we'll get a top writing tip that may change the way you work forever. It's from one of the most successful non-fiction authors in recent years. That's on the way in just a sec, after we dive into it with James Oswald then this week, starting as always with what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
I see the farmyard out the window in front of my computer. I see one of my 3 dogs upside down on the rug. I see a desk which is more mess than desk. And I see a keyboard.
Where are you in your house?
I've got a writing room, which is a large, enormously large room above the garage. I've built a house on the farm for myself. So part of the design was a writing room, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's just like it sounds. It's huge. I mean, that's the one thing. It's huge. It's like 80 square meters or something, which is bigger than the average wimpy home, apparently. And I just went over the top building it and thought, what's the best I can possibly have?
Well, let's expand on that then. I've chatted to over 40 authors now, and I can't really think of one, although they would all like to, who have built a writing room to spec. When you had your whole imagination to play with, you were building above your garage, what needed to be in there for you?
Well, it needed to have room for my guitars, because I play the guitar very badly, but I do like to pick up my guitar and strum when I'm thinking. It needed room for a telly. I wanted to have room for a grand piano, though I can't really play the piano. I haven't got a grand piano either. But it grew out of being the room above the garage, though, because the garage needed to be big enough for my classic cars. So it gets worse.
So there's a lot of different interests here.
Yes.
Then. With the guitars, with the piano that you can't really play, with the classic cars, what do you have sitting beneath you in the garage?
I have a 1967 Alfa Romeo Duetto Spider, which I bought as a wreck in about, I think, 1990. And it's taken me however many years that is, 28 years, to restore, and it's still an ongoing project.
Is it drivable?
It does drive, yes. I drove it the weekend before last, which was kind of its last drive before the winter sets in and they start putting salt on the roads. And it's great fun, but it needs a decent paint job, and it needs the suspension tweaked and all sorts of stuff. But I actually love tinkering with old cars more than driving them. I like tinkering with things, taking them apart and putting them back together again.
On the walls of the room that you've designed to spec, what can we see?
I do have a big whiteboard on wheels that I can wheel around, because I use that for plotting out ideas, themes and things, and just scribbling down notes and brainstorming when I'm writing. So there's usually things written on that, like what did they do with the head ? And then an arrow pointing to something else, like they ate it, or little things like that, you know, which would alarm people who wandered up there by mistake.
Brilliant. We'll come to it in just a sec. I just want to firmly get to grips with where you're actually writing. So on your bookshelves, what can we see? What are you reading?
It's a lot of crime books. I get sent an awful lot of like proof copies from publishers, hoping that I'll write nice things about them that they can put on the cover. Which I'm a really slow reader, so I don't get round to most of them, which is a shame, because there's loads of books there that I really want to read, and I'm just thinking soon I'll read them, and then that's like 3 years later, and I think, oh, I'm probably a bit late to send the editor a note about that one. Comics, I'm obsessed with comics. I've been reading comics since I was in short trousers, and I still do. I get a monthly order from a friend of mine runs a comic shop in Aberdeen. And he phones me up once a month with a pick list and any recommendations, and I send him some money, and then every 3 or 4 months I go up to Aberdeen, pick up a big box of comics and bring them back home and binge on them.
What do you think it is about, apart from it harking back to your childhood, what do you think it is about comics that draws you in? Is it, or perhaps the question should be, and this maybe it should come later, but what have you learned about writing through the conciseness of comics?
A great deal, actually, because I started off, when I first started trying to write professionally, I wrote comic scripts, and I sent some story ideas off to 2000 AD, and they sent me back, this is pre-internet, so you know, an envelope full of some old Judge Dredd scripts and instructions on how to actually construct a comic script, and it was some of the most useful writing advice I've ever had. And that discipline of you know, figuring out the story, not just how the story works, but then how it appears on the page, how each frame on a page is a scene in itself, and it has to feed into the next one, and it really concentrates on your dialogue, because that's your main way of moving the story on. And that actually happens a lot in my prose fiction now. If you read my books, you'll find there's a lot of dialogue in them, and the story gets moved on through dialogue, and I think that comes from learning how to write a comic script. I have a day job. I'm a livestock farmer. I run a 350-acre livestock farm in North East Fife. So my day job, I get up in the morning, I'll have some breakfast, I'll go out and check all the livestock. I've got Highland cattle and Romney sheep, and that will take, depending on the time of year and what's going on the farm, that could take up till lunchtime. So I don't tend to do much writing in the morning. I'm thinking about writing the whole time, and if I'm out in the tractor, I'll have my headphones on and be listening to an audio book or something like that. So it's not wasted time at all. I usually try to get some writing done during the day, but it depends on the farming routine. If there's something that needs doing in the afternoon, then that comes first. With this last couple of weeks, we've been getting the sheep ready for the ram going in with the ewes. And so that's involved gathering all the sheep, bringing them all down to the farmyard, giving them their dose of wormer, checking their feet, because their feet tend to get, you know, they have all sorts of problems with it, and they have to have a foot trim. So we call it giving them their pedicure. And then they get a little bit of a trim at the back end, which, you know, give them their Brazilian. And then they get put out with the ram. So the ram's gone in now, and we can pretty much forget about the sheep for the next month, just check on them every day to make sure that nobody's got stuck on their back or anything like that. So it's an easier period. I can get around the livestock quite quickly, and maybe I might even sit down at my desk at 11, 12 with a cup of coffee and get 200 or 300 words out before lunchtime, which I was like, if I can get something done in the morning, it's great, because it kind of sets my brain going. And then if I have to go off and do something else, I've got that start. Because I do most of my writing in the evening. I'll tend to do any admin or whatever that needs doing in the afternoon. And there's a lot of admin on the farm, a lot of paperwork and stuff that has to be dealt with. So I'll have supper, you know, about 6:30, 7:00. Watch a little bit of telly with my other half, though it's usually just the news or something. And then I'll go upstairs and I'll sit down and I'll be at my desk by either 7:30 or 8:00. And that's when I do most of my writing. And I'll write just solidly from then until 10:30, 11:00. Or if the muse has really got me, I'll carry on until about midnight. But at some point, my partner will come through and say, I'm going to bed. I've left the dogs through here, and leave it for me to put the dogs to bed later.
So that's about 3 hours work every evening. How much do you reckon you'll get through in 3 hours? If we are going to talk about word count, how much in words do you reckon?
In words, on a good day, I'll get 2,000 words done. At the moment, because I'm sort of in the first draft of a new novel at the moment, and I'm probably about halfway through, and I'm getting 1,000 to 1,500 words done, because I'm still finding out the story for myself. I'm not much of a plotter. That's probably a question you're going to ask later on. My first draft does tend to be me telling myself the story, working out how it's going to go. And there's a lot of, I don't go back and change stuff, but there's a lot of writing down notes saying, no, that avenue's the wrong way to go down, change that character to something else or whatever. So it's quite slow to start with. But as I get further into the book, and I know where I'm going, the word count gets bigger and bigger. If I've got a scene plotted out in my head, I can sit down and write it. I can do 1,500 words in an hour. It's no problem at all. I'm a reasonably fast typist, and it just flows. But a lot of time is spent sitting and staring into the distance and trying not to go onto Twitter.
I think that's the case with most writers, yeah, from what I've learned. I know that being a farmer is a full-time job in the most fullest sense of that word, but, you know, mostly 7 days a week. Is that the same for you while you're writing? Will you be there Monday through Sunday bashing out the words?
Yes, I always have been. I've always been a 7 day a week worker. I don't really have holidays, which is perhaps not very healthy, but it's just the way that I work. And yeah, I mean, livestock don't understand holidays, and they don't understand weekends, and they don't understand Christmas and Easter and things like that. It's just another day.
But one thing livestock do need, I'd imagine, is a fairly solid routine. They need things to happen in the morning every day. I mean, it's the first time worming sheep's ever been mentioned on the show.
It's the first time for everything.
But they need this regularity. Do you think that helps you out with your creativity, with getting the words and your story down on the page?
I think it probably does. I mean, it gives me a routine, which otherwise I probably wouldn't have. And before I was doing, before I took on the farm, I've been farming for about 10 years since my dad died. Before I took that on, I worked as an agricultural consultant, and I was living down in Wales. And that was a kind of a 9-to-5 job. And it was quite tricky, having done a 9-to-5 job, to then think, right, well, now I'm going to write some stuff in the evening. Because the temptation is just to cook supper, have a beer, sit in front of the telly. Mm. But I did, after a while, get into the habit of mainly because there was nothing on the telly, going upstairs and just sitting at my desk and writing. And I think that's where it started, actually. So when I came to take on the farm, it made sense in the evenings. There was, you know, once I'd done the farm work, rather than switch on the telly, I'd sit down, switch on my computer and start writing.
So that's the start of your writing career. If you were to fast forward to the end of it, or to the end of your farming life right now, is the goal to just be a full-time writer? Or because of the way the farm is, it's in your family?
It's a family farm. It's quite a difficult thing to walk away from. I was asked this question yesterday when I was doing a library group, a reading group meeting, and someone said, you know, would you go full time? And I said, my dream was to be able to go to my boss and say, take your job and shove it.
It's hard when you're your own boss. Yeah,
but exactly, when the time finally came, when I was, you know, I got my big breakthrough publishing deal, and it was like I could afford to give up my job. I was self-employed, and running a family farm, and I didn't particularly want to give it up. What I have done is I've cut back the livestock numbers. When my dad was running the farm, we had 500 ewes and 50 breeding cows. I've got 50 ewes, so a tenth of the number, and I've got 19 breeding cows, but probably only about 15, 16 of them going to the bull for various reasons. So it's a fraction of the numbers, which means I can get round everything a lot quicker and I'm not completely exhausted at the end of the day.
You're speaking to someone who very rarely does any physical exertion at all. I mean, I run a podcast. What do you find more satisfying, or are they not really equatable?
Differently satisfying. 3 days of solid labour, well, I haven't done for a long time, so, and I'm quite glad of that. There is something very satisfying to getting any job completed. So it's you know, you get to the end of the line and you push the last ewe outside and say, off you go. And that's like job done. That's satisfying. And it's the same when you get to the end of a chapter or you get to the end of a draft and it's like job done. That's really satisfying. The actual doing it is hell, though. I think it's Dorothy Parker who says, I hate writing, love having written. There's nothing like the feeling of finishing something, but when you're doing it, it's just hell. Well, the idea kind of evolved, as all my story ideas do. The first thing that came was the character, the main character in the book, Constance Fairchild. And she started as a first name a long, long time ago. I remember having a conversation with another writer about character names, and he wanted a character name that reflected the character. So someone who was really steadfast and reliable would be called Constance. And we got talking about how it would be fun to do that ironically as well. So you could have someone who was not, you know, someone who was completely unreliable, a bit ditzy and flighty, and call her Constance. And you could have someone who was really irritable and wanting to get on with things and call her Patience and things like that. And I just remembered that conversation. It must have been about 10 years ago. And I always wanted to write a character called Constance, but have her not be. And when I used to be published by Penguin, and I've just recently moved to Headline. And one of the things that we would agree to do when I moved to Headline was to write a new series. And so I was coming up with an idea for a completely new series. And I remembered this conversation and this name, Constance. So I thought, well, I'm going to have a detective called Constance, but she's going to be anything but. But as I wrote the character, she started to come out. She completely changed. I mean, she became a very constant, a very reliable and steadfast character anyway. But I started with that name. And because she was called Constance, I was thinking, well, that's kind of a... What's the phrase they use? It's a grace name or whatever. There's a sort of family tradition of calling your children things like faith and hope and charity and constance and earnest and benevolence and all these, and verity and all these things. And I thought, well, what kind of family does that? And it's a very historied family. And that then made me think about, sort of a vaguely aristocratic family, but she's a detective Which doesn't really fit in with that. I didn't want to have a Lord Peter Wimsey type thing going on. So then that meant that the character had to have fought against her background. So she had to be a reason for that. And just sparking the character off that. And then the story then came out of really my exploring her background as much as anything else. So she's a detective constable in the Met. Okay, so what's she doing? She's working undercover. In a small team, and the op goes wrong, and that gave me my opening. So the opening scene in the book is basically her going to this this office that they're running as an undercover part of an undercover op to find her boss dead with a bullet through his head, and then it's just a series of questions that come on from that. What's going on? Who did this to her, and why? And I was also, because obviously she's a woman, so I was writing her at the point of the character, point of view of a woman. And so I was thinking about men portraying women in fiction and what they get wrong the whole time, and trying very hard not to do that. And listening to all my friends who are women and what they're saying.
What do they get wrong the whole time, quickly?
Breasts, basically. Okay. In one word. If you there's been an ongoing sort of discussion among various writers about it, and there's examples of almost every literary author who's ever written a female character mentions at some point in the book their breasts in a male gaze way, and it's something that women don't do. They're just there. You know, and I've spoken to some of my female friends, and one of them that said, yeah, the only time that she really thought about her breasts was at the end of a long day when she took off her bra, and it was like, oh God, thank God for that. And it's in a that, you know, just a sort of relaxing. Whereas if you read some of these passages, you know, it's quite pornographic in some ways. These you know, women studying themselves in the mirror and thinking they're looking quite perky and things like that, and people don't think about themselves that way, and so that was the, you know, just not thinking about that sort of stuff when I was writing her character made it so much easier, but it was an interesting exercise.
You've decided that you want to write a female character in a way that very few males get the chance to do and have the ability to do. Then what do you do? So you've really fleshed out your character here. You've thought about her name, you've thought about her family, you've put her into this plot. You've already said that you're not much of a planner, but you do have a whiteboard in your writing room. Talk to me about what you do next. When you've got that initial idea, that initial elevator pitch, the opening has been written, what happens next?
Well, what I usually do, and bearing in mind I'm coming to this book having written 8 books in a different crime fiction series, where I've got a team of detectives that I know well, I write that first scene and then I literally throw my detectives at it and see what happens. And so I was kind of doing the same thing. And I worked out fairly early on that Constance was a bit of a loner. She's different. She's female in a male-dominated place. She's posh, even though she's trying to hide that as much as possible in a, you know, in a very working-class environment. And because of that, she's a bit isolated. And the person who gets killed in the, you know, she finds dead at the beginning, is, as she describes in the opening scene, her perhaps only friend in the force. He's gone, so suddenly she's ankle-less, and she's drifting, and people are blaming her for it. So that kind of gives me a dynamic in the work. She's being pushed out by her colleagues, shunned by her colleagues, or blamed by her colleagues. So she just has to go and do everything for herself. And she has to, you know, she has to fall back on her wits to try and find out what's going on, and who set her up, because it looks increasingly like she's been set up to take the fall for this, that kind of just the story just spitballed off that. So my whiteboard tended to have like Pete dead, an arrow pointing to a question mark, who killed him. And actually, that didn't get filled in until quite a lot. You know, I was like 30,000 words into the novel before I'd worked that one out. So I don't really know where the story's going to go when I start. I've got a very vague idea of how it's going to end.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We'll be back with more from James Oswald in just a sec. Very quickly, before we get a top writing tip that may change the way that you work forever, I wanted to remind you of all the ways that you can get in touch with us at the show, if you like what we're doing. Head to our website, you can listen to all the episodes that you may have missed so far, and you can get all the different ways to listen to them as well. You can also find out loads more about the authors that we have chatted to. Send us a message while you're on there. There's a little form to fill out. It's dead simple, over at writersroutine.com. And you can get pretty much daily posts to help with your writing over on our Twitter page. It's also the best place to get a quick reply. You can find us on there. We are at WritersPod. And we're having fun on Instagram as well with nice, glossy, jazzed up photos of the writers that we've spoke to. It's Writers Routine on there. Right, it's time for a top writing tip that may change the way that you work forever. We do this more or less every week on the show. We kind of collar the writers that we've spoken to in the past just after the interview and wheedle out one tiny little bit of advice for you. This week it's from Tim Marshall, whose book Prisoners of Geography, it's been huge over the last few years. You can't really move at the moment for tube ads for it around London. And it tells the story of how you can look at maps to predict pretty big political changes all across the world. Now this tip, I warn you, it's short, it's sweet, it's straight to the point, but pretty helpful, I'd say.
Hello, I'm Tim Marshall. My latest book is called Divided, Why We're Living in an Age of Walls, and my writing tip is as follows. If you want to write, follow this maxim or this dictum, arse to seat, fingers to keyboard.
I mean, I did warn you. You can catch up with all of that episode with Tim Marshall, the full thing. It's over right now on the iTunes podcast store. You can find us on Spotify, and it's there at writersroutine.com. Let's get back into it then with this week's guest, James Oswald, the farmer by day and crime writer by night. His book, No Time to Cry, it's all about a brand new character called Constance Fairchild. Now, in this, you'll hear what he's learned about writing from both the fantasy and the crime genres. Also, how tending to cattle and sheep through the day helps him think things through. And we pick things up with that first draft, the vomit draft, as we've so often heard about on this show. What does he do to get it down?
So my first draft is very much a vomit draft. It's just getting everything out. And quite often I'll get to a point and realise that actually I've made a mistake, that something doesn't add up, and I need to do something differently earlier on in the book to make something work. And that's at that point, I tend not to go back and rewrite until I've finished. So I will just make myself a little note somewhere and say this needs to be changed in the redraft, and carry on writing as if I had made the change. So my first draft, if you were to read it through, would make no sense. You know, characters change sex halfway through and things like that. But I kind of impose the structure on it once I've got the finished thing, the first draft finished. And it's just a system that's worked for me. And I never really think in terms of like the three-act structure or the five-act structure, or at this point you need to be introducing the antagonist or whatever. I just do really write very organically.
So this is your ninth crime novel. You're eight in a previous series in Spectre MacLean.
Yeah, and I've written five fantasy novels as well, as a five-book fantasy series which Penguin published as well.
So I'm just curious, without pushing you on this, I'm curious. You must know what needs to be in a crime thriller if this is the ninth one that you have written. When you sat down to write this book, No Time to Cry, what did you know that needed to be in it?
That's an interesting way of putting it. I've never really... I don't really think about what needs to be... I mean, it needs to be an adventure. There needs to be conflict. There needs to be peril. The main character has to be put through the ringer, so I've got to make life really difficult for her. And that's possibly the only thing I really think about as I'm going through. You know, is this too easy? What's the more difficult way of doing this? With each new step of the book going on. But as I say, I really do not plot very much at all. You'd be astonished at how little. I have my whiteboard, and I have a Word file which I open up, which I usually call thinking with my fingers, with just something that a habit that I've had over the years. And I literally, I'll type out, because I find that easier than writing by hand, because my handwriting is illegible. I type out ideas and work out things, you know, what's Constance going to do in the next couple of pages. She needs to do this, this, and this. And quite often, having written that, I will then write something completely different, because I'm not very good at rereading my notes. So it probably wouldn't matter if I wrote them in longhand anyway. But most of it goes on in my head, which is, I think, again, to come back to the farming, which is why the farming's quite useful, because I can be going around and checking the livestock and things are just churning over in my head. And sometimes even subconsciously, things are just I've got to a point in the book and I'm thinking, well, I need to work out what's going to happen next, and I'll go away and I'll do a half a day of checking the livestock or moving the cows from one field to another or whatever, and I'll come back and I'll sit down, and it's just there.
Talk to me about the cleanup then. If the start is your vomit draft. Mm-hmm. When you've got your story down, what's the first thing that you do when you're editing, when you're cleaning things up? I mean, you're 9 crime novels in. There must be some system.
Yeah, there is a system. I've got my notes that I've taken whilst I've been writing, like, you know, change Jack to Jill or whatever. And I read the whole thing through to myself. And I use Scrivener. I don't know if... Scrivener is quite useful because I can see very easily that it's chapter 1, scene 1, scene 2, scene 3 or whatever. And a little description of what each scene is about. And I read the whole thing through, and I write, I have a notepad, A4 pad by my side, and I write down a little description of each scene and a little note of what needs to be changed in it. And I go through the whole book, so it might be, you know, 60, or I think that's about 60 chapters in that book, because they're quite short chapters. That's another thing that I like to do. I like short chapters, short scenes. I usually try to keep my scenes down to less than 1,000 words each.
Why is that?
Because it makes the book read really quickly. That's the trick to a page turner. Lots of chapters, short scenes.
If we're also talking about the format of the book, it's all in the first present tense.
Yeah.
How much of a conscious decision is that? Why is it written in that style?
That came out, I was very self-conscious about writing a female character. And I thought, right, the only way to do it properly is to completely immerse yourself in the character. So it made sense to write it from her point of view. The Tony McLane books are all largely written from Tony McLane's point of view, but they're third person. So McLane did this, McLane did that. But for some obscure reason, when I sat down to write the first opening scene of that, I was right in Constance's head, following her up the stairs, finding her boss, seeing her boss with a hole in his forehead and the brains spattered out on the and it just, it worked. And I thought, yeah, this is what we need, because we need to be with her. It's her book. We need to follow her around that closely. And I just carried on writing it that way. I'd done that once before for an unpublished novel with a male protagonist, and quite liked it that as a way of writing.
What changes about doing it? I mean, this may be really nuanced and there's not many changes at all, and that's fine. But as a writer, is it different telling your story when you're right there in someone's head?
It is. And one of the biggest problems is you haven't got other character points of view to play off. And as I was saying earlier, my books are quite dialogue driven, and you... it's a bit difficult if you're actually in the character's head completely, first person, to do as much dialogue. So you need more action, you need more things to do. And the other thing, I didn't want to be constantly reflecting on things. So, you know, the endless internal monologues get really boring after a while. That was one of the things I found with my fantasy series. The first draft of the first book in the fantasy novel, there were endless internal monologues, lots and lots of introspection by the main character, who was a dragon as it happened, but that doesn't really matter. And it was really boring. And, you know, there wasn't actually very much happening. It was just lots and lots of this character, you know, bemoaning life or whatever. And I learned from that, as you do. You know, a friend of mine pointed out to me that this was really boring. I read and thought, yeah, you're right, it is really boring. And you move on and you start writing differently. And writing Constance from the first person point of view meant that you got a few of her internal thinking, but it's posed also, or it's not Constance thought this, it's like, what's this? You know, actually written in there as a question, and it makes it much more immediate. You think about the language she's going to use, the you know, she's quite well educated, so she, you know, she has a certain amount of sort of learned intelligence, and her vocabulary is larger than maybe the average beat coppers, I don't know, but she has a way of speaking and a way of thinking which is different to some of the other characters in the books. But she is curiously quite sweary, which is something I have noticed about some of the posh girls that I met growing up, that they were quite casual about dropping the F-bomb.
So is that considered from you then, or did you know that she was going to be sweary?
Yeah, I think she was always going to be... She's basically uninhibited in that respect. She doesn't care what other people think about her. So if she feels like swearing because she's really pissed off about something, then she will. That's kind of also fighting against her upbringing, because obviously swearing, casual swearing like that, is something that her parents would most definitely frown upon and you know, berate her for. And likewise, she went to a posh private school and would have been beaten for anything like that. So that's kind of a fighting against that as well.
You're an author and a farmer. You live up in Scotland. You've worked in Wales in agriculture. It's a far cry from the corrupt Met Police that you're writing about. How did you go about researching this?
Now, I get into a lot of trouble here because I do very little research, certainly procedural research, for any of my books. I've written 9 books now in the Inspector MacLean series, which are marketed as police procedurals. I've never spoken to a police officer about any aspect of the fiction. You can learn the basics by watching The Bill or reading the books of other great authors who've also probably learnt most of it from reading the books of other great authors. I'm one of these truly lazy people who put a lot of effort into being lazy. I'm also a little bit shy about and nervous about going to the police and asking them questions. I don't want to waste their time. And so I've kind of developed a strategy of working around it. And you'll find in that book, she's a police officer. She's working in a small team undercover. We don't even name what department that's in. She works out of an anonymous police station in a part of London that's not... ever, we don't say that it's in, you know, it's not Bethnal Green or something. It's just a police station somewhere. She lives in a part of London in an rented ex-council flat. But I never say exactly where that is. It's just generic. And I'm not really interested in tying the story down to absolute police procedure and parts of London. I don't know London well enough.
Do you think it matters, though?
I don't think it does. And I mean, unless an aspect of the story absolutely turns on something being totally accurate, I don't think it does matter. And I do sometimes get a bit frustrated with this myth that crime fiction is always meticulously researched, and things like CSI and The Bill, they have specialists in who make sure that they're getting everything right. No, they have specialists in who make sure that they're getting everything plausible. I did a big panel interview thing at Bloody Scotland, which is a crime fiction festival in Stirling, last year with Dame Professor Sue Black, the forensic pathologist. And it was great fun, though I was slightly terrified that she was going to take apart my forensic knowledge, which is non-existent. But actually, I was chatting to her, and the thing that frustrates her most, because she's, you know, one of the country's most foremost experts on forensic pathology, she gets asked to be an expert witness at trials a lot, and she explains in complex stuff in layman's terms to juries. And then they don't believe her because they've seen it on CSI. They think they're experts because they've read a couple of crime novels or they've seen The Bill. And it's really, really frustrating because there's this myth that we're writing stuff which is true to life. We're not. We're making up stories to entertain. And as long as they're plausible, as long as you don't have your police doing something which they would obviously not do, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter that it's not how it is not reality.
That is it then for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to James Oswald. You can find out loads more about his book, No Time to Cry, right now over at writersroutine.com. And while you're there, you can send us a message to let us know what you think about the show. If you've got any authors that you would like me to chat to, maybe you're a writer yourself, you want to come on here and plug your wares, that's fine. You can send a message over at writersroutine.com. If you've enjoyed the show as well, remember the best thing that you can do to help us out is to leave us a review over on the iTunes podcast store. You can follow us on Twitter at WritersPod, Instagram WritersRoutine. And that's it from us for 2018. Have a fantastic break and an exceedingly merry Christmas. I will see you in the new year with more writing routines. Thank you very much. We'll see you then. Bye.